Solidarity, number 706, 17th of April, 2024. Page 2. The Loot of the Billionaires. Editorial. A few thousand billionaires, 2,781 according to the latest report from Forbes magazine, own $14.2 trillion in wealth, up to $2 trillion 14% from 2023. The billionaires and about 60 million millionaires make the core of the world's ruling class. They have huge luxuries. The first guiding principle of economic life under capitalism is to make these ultra-rich even richer, that is, to maximize profits. They have big houses, private jets, and other luxuries. Most of their wealth, though, is financial wealth. Shares, bonds, and other tickets to future profit income, the wealth that also gives power over workers. Most ultra wealth comes from already wealth. Most got richer because they started out rich. Forbes notes that, quotes, every billionaire under 30 inherited his or her fortune, end quotes. A few a bit older are self-made, though they mostly came from well-off, if not quite, millionaire backgrounds. The biggest exception is Palmer Tuckey, a US capitalist and strident Trump supporter, who started his fortune by designing a VR headset. His dad was a car salesman. All of them, even Tuckey, owe their wealth to getting into a position where their own or control means of production, so can siphon off the excess value above wages produced by wage workers employed on those means of production. Generally, inventors and scientists who make discoveries do not get rich. The world's top billionaire is Barnard R. Holt, whose fortune comes from LMVH selling bling and other well-off people. Oxfam calculates, quotes, a progressive wealth tax between 2% and 5% rate on the EU's multimillionaires and billionaires could collect 286.5 billion euros annually. This money could pay for more than half of the highest estimates of the world's annual costs for climate crisis adaptation and mitigation in low and middle class countries. A person from the richest 1% emits on average 14 times more carbon CO2 than a person in the bottom 50%. A European wealth tax could also address the excessive emissions of the super rich, end quotes. That is true and immediate, but only a start. Even dividing up the mansions of the rich and redirecting luxury hotels and restaurants to housing and feeding the worst off is only a start. Our aim is not the redistribution of wealth among households. During the revolution of 1848, according to legend, Amschel Mayer Rothschilds would offer a few coins to each passerby on the streets of Frankfurt, telling them that he had calculated their share if his fortune were divided equally among the whole population. Most of them shrugged. Our aim is to win social ownership and democratic control of the vast productive wealth of the billionaires and millionaires, and to redirect investments democratically to social and green goals. The issue is class power. Who rules? The billionaires with their profits drive, or the working class with our imperatives of social solidarity and social foresight? The issue will be resolved only by working class strength and power, that is, by democratic and politically educated working class organisation in working workplaces and communities. Solidarity works for that day by day, week by week, in times of working class reflux, as well as times of advance. The working class and the overpaid. Socialism versus Capitalism by Martin Thomas. One of the biggest arguments of Marxists against utopian socialists from the start was about class struggle and socialism. Many socialists argued that everyone, or everyone except a tiny minority, would prefer socialism. Maybe the working class suffered most and so would benefit most, but everyone would gain from maximizing the good socialist elements of society. But as Marx put it in History, quote, it is the bad side that produces the movements by providing a struggle, end quotes. Socialist class struggle will prevail only by defeating the capitalist class and a sizable layer of what Marx calls the, quotes, middle class, who are a burden weighing heavily on the working base and increase the social security and power of the upper 10,000, end quotes. Marxists think we can and need to win support of a sizable chunk of better-off people. Enthusiasing in 1893 about the growth of the socialist movement in Germany, Engels wrote, quote, our ideas are making headway everywhere, as much among teachers, doctors, lawyers, etc., as among the workers. If we had to start wielding power tomorrow, we should need engineers, chemists, agronomists. It is my conviction that we would have a good many of them behind us already, end quotes. And as workers' rule flourished, many former rich kids will come to value the social advantages above individual luxury and the joys of command. Many better off workers too will become happy to do without extra stuff and retail therapy. Even in capitalism, above a certain level, less unequal societies are happier and less fraught than richer, but more unequal ones. The super rich are often unhappy. But there is no getting round the battle today against overpay and the people deeply attached to overpay. The principle of workers' rule is that managerial jobs are elected and done at workers' wages. The Bolsheviks in Russia after October 1917, knowing they could only improvise in an impoverished country where socialism could gain less middle-class support than in Germany, set a party maximum so party members who held government posts could get no more than a skilled worker. Scrabbling to sustain administration, they agreed bourgeois specialists could be paid more, but only as long as their decisions were vetted. As Stalinism advanced, the party maximum was circumvented, then abolished, and the pay hierarchies became steeper than in the West. Today, however, in the UK, top managers pleads that they must be paid more. They do not dare claim that they deserve or need more, only that US firms pay more and so UK firms risk losing talent. The process of vying for top manager jobs has been shown to favour psychopathic traits. The anecdotal evidence is that 21st century professional managers are possibly good at doing each other down, but if anything worse than old-fashioned up-from-the-ranks managers at organising production in an efficient and human-friendly way. Let the super-paid managers flee. Fellow workers, elected by and accountable to their workmates, can do the managing and organising work better and at workers' wages. Page 3. Solidarity with Peace Activists in Israel by Ira Bekovic. How can Israel's war on Gaza be stopped? There is no easy answer, and the sense of helpless despair many feel in the face of mounting slaughter is understandable. But we do no service to the victims of those horrors if we allow our despair to numb us into inaction. On 13th of April, thousands marched in central London to demand a ceasefire and that Britain stop arming Israel. Such demonstrations have undoubtedly contributed to an atmosphere of international pressure on Israel. The demand that international governments suspend military aid to Israel or withdraw licenses under which firms based in their countries sell arms to this Israeli state is also important. Should it be won on any scale, it would add still further to diplomatic pressure. But while a long-term suspension or cancellation of aid from Israel's chief ally, the USA, would over time degrade Israel's military capacity, it is unlikely to have much immediate operational impact on the war. And in Britain, the demand is almost wholly symbolic. Sales from British-based firms account for 0.02% of Israel's military imports. Demanding governments increase humanitarian aid to Palestinians, including via significant increases in funding to UNRWA, the UN agency perhaps best placed to administer and redistribute aid, is also vital. Israel's restrictive control of border crossings and difficulties in distribution within Gaza, with allegations of Hamas fighters confiscating aid, make the situation challenging, but underline the need for activist pressure in wealthy, powerful nations to demand more decisive action. Direct donations to humanitarian charities like medical aid for Palestinians can also help. The international institutions of the labour movements, vastly less wealthy than governments and states, but hardly impoverished, can also do more to fundraise. The International Transport Workers Federation, Federation's Palestinian Union Solidarity Fund, which works with the Palestine General Federation of Trade Unions to administer aid, provides a model. Solidarity has argued that the pressure to which Israel's warmongering Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remains most vulnerable is internal. Anti-government demonstrations have swelled in recent weeks, with demands from families of Israeli hostages captive in Gaza for an argument that secures their release increasingly at the centre of them. Standing together, the left-wing Arab-Jewish social movement has intervened in the demonstrations to argue that only a comprehensive political agreement, including a ceasefire and peace talks towards a permanent settlement guaranteeing equal rights to both peoples, Palestinians and Jews, can guarantee safety and security. Although Standing Together as a movement has no formal policy on what the settlement should be, many of its leaders believe, as Solidarity does, that it must begin with the establishment of an independent Palestinian state alongside a secure Israel. The international movement against the war must also be an international movement of solidarity with their efforts. Voices from Inside Israel by Alan Lee Green, National Co-Director of Standing Together. Quotes, "We are here at the Horev Center, Haifa, and we are here with the campaign, the Camp of Life, the camp that is demanding a ceasefire now, that is demanding a hostage deal now, a deal that will stop the killing and destruction in Gaza and bring the hostages back alive. We know that the majority of the people that live here want to live and are against the camp of death led by the Israeli government," end quotes, by Sally Abed, one of the Palestinian leaders of Standing Together, speaking from an anti-government protest in Haifa on Saturday the 6th of April. Quotes, and this is from Alan Lee Green, 14,000 Palestinian children have been killed since the war began. That's 77 Palestinian children killed every day for the 180 days of the war. Think about it, 77 Palestinian children a day. If 77 Israeli children were killed every day, we we would lose our minds. The only way to live here is to understand that there are 7 million Palestinians here who are not going anywhere, and there are 7 million Jews here who are also not going anywhere. If we do not succeed in living together where every person has security, equality, freedom and independence, then none of us will have a life here. So it's time for a ceasefire, time to end the war, bring the Israeli hostages home and get rid of the fascists in power. End quotes. Keep pressing for ceasefire and peace. Indirect negotiations between Israel and Hamas conducted in Qatar are formally ongoing but apparently deadlocked. The latest proposal for a temporary ceasefire and hostage release agreement would reportedly see 40 Israeli hostages, either women, children or the elderly, released in exchange for some hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. International press reports say Hamas has claimed it is not holding 40 hostages in those categories. Moreover, it remains intransigent over any deal that does not involve a permanent ceasefire. From the point of view of Hamas's leaders, prolonging the war makes a certain sense, but for the people of Gaza, a temporary ceasefire is surely preferable to none at all. Hamas's intransigence suggests a callousness towards the lives of the people it claims to represent. Intransigence on the Israeli side also suggests that it sees the still living hostages as expendable. Of the 111 hostages freed, only one was rescued by direct military action. All others were released as part of a ceasefire agreement in November. The hope for a democratic future in the region, although presently remote, rests substantially on the shoulders of dissident movements in Israel, Iran, and elsewhere. It is the prime duty of internationalists to offer them as much direct support and solidarity as we can. Activist agenda. Meetings. Thursday, the 18th of April, 7 p.m. The Carnation Revolution at Marchmont Community Centre, London, WC1N1AB. Thursdays, 2nd of May to the 6th of June, 8 p.m. Zoom study group on theses on Feuerbach. Template motions. Texts to adopt for union branches and Labour parties. Top of the list currently, no work notices, abortion, decriminalisation. Socialist feminist book clubs on Sheffield's 6th of May. At work or on campus, we organise among health and local government, school and education workers on the railway and London Underground, in the civil service, on uni campuses and more. See workersliberty.org/workunions. Campaigns. 4. UK Friends of Standing Together, Labour Left Internationalists, Workers Against the CCP, Free Our Unions, Solidarity with the Iranian Workers, Neurodivergence Labour, India Labour Solidarity, Ukraine Solidarity Campaign, Labour Campaign for Free Movement. For contact details, activities and template motions, see workersliberty.agenda. For environmental campaign, including mobilisation for Reclaim the Power at Drax in August, email workersliberty. The Ukraine Social Solidarity Campaign has launched a fund appeal for PPE and other equipment to go to the 10th Mining Rescue Squad in Ukraine. Page 4. Watching the Real World, Eye on the Left by Rodri Evans. On Saturday, some of us were walking from a Workers' Liberty meeting in York to the rail station. At one junction, we couldn't remember whether to turn left or right. We looked at Google Maps on our phones. Before we could see the answer there, one of us glanced at the Real World. There was the station, visible on our right. With the Don't Vote Labour agitation on the sort of left now. It's an inverse problem. Look on your smartphone and it's huge. Watch the real world and it's elusive. None of the groups, collective, no ceasefire, no vote, NCNV, transform, we deserve better, workers' party, to street stalls or leafleting or paper sales or demonstrations or intervening in unions. In 1996-7, Arthur Scargill's Socialist Labour Party, an electoral left of Labour effort, had for a while a paper street stalls, branches, visible activity. Now the stir is all electoral only. NCNV and Collective held their second conference in Blackburn on the 13th of April. Socialist Worker and Morning Star both report about 150 there, not many more than the first meeting on 3rd of March. Socialist Worker says it was rather aimless until George Galloway, the top billed speaker, intervened. Quotes, he rallied much of the room behind him with all the dangers that represents, quotes, adds SW. The SWP had a bad time with Galloway 20 years ago and notes Galloway's reactionary campaigning against LGBT plus rights, against migrants and against greening of economic life. His Rochdale campaign was not a poor left-wing vote, but right-wing. The Socialist Party praised Galloway in Rochdale and gives Galloway's Workers' Party observer status in its TUSC electoral vehicle. It is pressing for a deal between TUSC and the Workers' Party to share out constituencies in the general election and offer mutual support. Although Morning Star contributor Andrew Murray is keen for Galloway, the MS's report from 13th of April was non-committal. The NCNV conference clashed directly with a conference in London of the Peace and Justice Project of Jeremy Corbyn. That conference was bigger, 200, and wasn't a no Labour vote effort. It had PCS Union General Secretary Fran Heathcote on its platform and campaigns like Keep Our NHS Public Busy within it. It discussed the five demands of the PJP, which Collective has also adopted. The follow-up seems unclear to me. The PJP neither runs street stalls or similar itself, nor organises motions and such to sway the Labour movement. Corbyn looks set to stand against Labour in the general election, but as an independent backed by his local Labour Party rather than as a PJP candidate. I'm told Galloway was not mentioned at all from the PJP platform. It's a mess, but look closely and there is a messy something in real life as well as on your smartphone. Even though Labour is doing well in the polls overall, real-world doorstep work for the 2nd of May elections show many Labour-minded people disgusted with Starmer. Galloway, rich enough to pay campaign activists, may do well in the Rochdale Council elections. Jamie Driscoll dissociates from Galloway, and he campaigns as the person best able to attract central government's handouts to the North East rather than as a leftist, but he may well win North East's mayor. Other sort of leftish independents will probably win here and there on 2nd of May. Corbyn may win Islington North in the general election. It's something, but it's a mess, and a not very left-wing mess, as shown by Galloway and by the Morning Star's remonstration that a new left party must avoid calling itself socialist or anti-capitalist. A chunk of Corbyn-era returners who joins Labour after 2015, after previously being politically active in the 1980s, seem to have moved in on thinking that the Israel embassy robbed them of their chance to get the government of their wishes in 2019 and is now running Starmer. Whether conspiracy theories was weak or strong with them before, it is worse now. Leftists disgusted with Starmer will do better to grit our teeth and redouble the political battle inside the Labour movement than to be pulled in the wake of their conspiracy theorists and Galloway. Jim Denham is away, so no antidoto this week. From Madrid to Kiev by Eric Lee, founder editor of Labour Start, writing here in a personal column. A little more than 85 years ago, on 28th of March 1939, the Spanish Civil War ended. The fascist forces under the command of General Franco entered the capital, Madrid, and it was all over. Spain did not see freedom again for nearly four decades. There are many reasons why the Spanish Republic fell, some of them due to failures by the Republican leadership. But one outstanding reason was the lack of support that the Spanish Republic received from democratic states like Britain, France, and the United States. While Nazi Germany and fascist Italy provided weapons, ammunition, and air support to the fascists, the Western democracies kept up an arms embargo. It was an unfair fight from the beginning because of that. The French socialist Léon Blum, leading a popular front government, was so frightened of the possibility of a civil war breaking out on his own country that he betrayed the Spanish Republic. He not only prevented French support reaching Spain, but actively encouraged dozens of other democracies, including Britain, to join the embargo as well. The Soviet Union, under Stalin's leadership, did step in and provide support for the embattled Spanish Republicans. They sent aid and military advisers to help the Spanish fight for a time, but they also sent their secret police to suppress any opposition. George Orwell witnessed that firsthand and barely escaped Barcelona alive. The parallels between Spain in the 1930s and Ukraine today are obvious. The authoritarian Putin regime in Russia is throwing everything it has at Ukraine, backed by the weaponry of Iran and North Korea. Ukraine is getting loads of support from its Baltic neighbours and some other European nations, including Britain. But its most important source of defensive weapons, the United States, has disappeared from the scene. The Republican Party, whose unchallenged leadership is Donald Trump, has done everything possible to prevent the United States from arming Ukraine, giving it the tools to defend itself. There remains some Republican leaders who still support Ukraine, but they are fighting an uphill battle. Trump personally feels close to the Russian leader and has insisted that if re-elected president later this year, he will end the conflict in Ukraine in one day. This is just bluster. He has no plan to end the war. What he means is that he'll fully cut Ukraine off from getting American support, allowing the Russians to win. A Russian victory in Ukraine cannot be allowed to happen, and it is not inevitable. Ukraine can still win this war. We on the left and on the trade unions must make sure that the tragedy of Franco's victory is not repeated later this year in Ukraine. We will do that by campaigning around the simple, easy-to-understand slogan, Arm Ukraine. In the US, it means that the left must support President Joe Biden's efforts to pass legislation to arm Ukraine. This is not yet the case. Bernie Sanders, who initially condemned the Russian invasion in 2022, has now joined Republicans in voting against sending help to the embattled Ukrainians. Sanders said he denied support for Biden's aid package for Ukraine because, as he explained, it included support for Israel and other countries. But he offered no credible alternative to choosing instead to vote to block Biden's bill. Democratic Socialists of America exploded in growth thanks to the Sanders presidential campaigns and is today the largest socialist organization in American history. It includes many individuals who would welcome a Russian victory, if that remains the view of most of the American left. The country urgently needs a new left, one committed to Ukrainian victory. In Britain, things are better, with the Labour Party still supporting Ukraine thanks in part to the work of organisations like the Ukraine Solidarity Campaign, and Keir Starmer has been unwavering in his commitment to Ukraine. 85 years ago, we could not save Spain. We said, no Passerani, but the fascists did pass. This year we must make sure that this Spanish tragedy is not repeated. Arm Ukraine now. Page 5. Inequalities in fertility care. Women's Fight Back by Katie Dollar. The UK's fertility regulator, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, HFEA, has found that IVF outcomes have varied widely for black, Asian and minority ethnic background patients compared to white patients. The report issued December 2023 gives data up to 2021. The average IVF birth rate per embryo transferred has increased across all ethnic groups. However, black and Asian patients aged 18 to 37 had lower birth rates at 23% and 24% respectively in 2020 to 21. White patients had 32%. Single black and Asian patients are also accessing fertility treatment far later than their white counterparts, which can have a huge impact on success rates. The study shows that these women started fertility treatment at 38, 39 years of age compared to 36.2 years for white single patients. Black parents who conceived via fertility treatment were the most likely to have multiple births, which carry a higher rate of complications for birth mother and baby. The findings highlight another area of racial discrepancy in material health and care. Black mothers are more likely to die from childbirth and have a 43% higher chance of miscarriage. The proportion of IVF cycles which are NHS funded among patients under 40 in heterosexual relationships has decreased across all ethnic groups. However, it decreased the most among black patients in heterosexual couples, down from 60% in 2019 to 41% in 2021. IVF is only offered on the NHS if certain criteria are met. If you don't meet these criteria, you may need to pay for private treatment. If you meet the criteria, you are offered 3 rounds of IVF under 40 as opposed to 1 if you are aged 40 plus. The HFEA, the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and the British Fertility Society and Fertility Network have called for action to ensure black, Asian and ethnic minority patients and their partners of adequate access to fertility treatment. The widespread NHS cuts means it is increasingly difficult to access fertility care. Fewer people can access it, and those who can do so in less safe conditions. Workers' Liberty will campaign for the labour movement to push labour to restore funding and reverse privatisation in the NHS by taxing the rich, and to level up to end inequality within healthcare. Red Sea and Yemen's peoples under Houthi attack by Dan Katz. the ultra-reactionary Houthi Islamist movement, which controls most of Yemen, continues to target shipping in the Red Sea with missiles and drones in support of Hamas in Palestine. According to Houthi leader Abdul Malik al-Houthi, speaking on 4th of April, 424 US-British airstrikes on Houthi targets have killed 37 people. The US and UK hope to prevent the attacks, which are causing shipping companies to reroute vessels and disrupting global supply chains. The US-led attacks began in January 2024, and we warned in solidarity they were unlikely to succeed in stopping the Houthis. Unfortunately, that has been proved to be correct. Shipping through the Red Sea is down to about 40% as usual. Al-Houthi claims that the movements launched 34 attacks in the last month, using 125 ballistic missiles and drones. Some experts say the attacks are in fact diminishing. The US is now looking for a diplomatic way out and expressing the hope that the Houthis are running out of munitions. Inside Yemen, the position of the Houthis has been strengthened. The regime is highly repressive. Dissidents are often accused of various forms of immorality. A judge who used social media to criticize the Houthi attacks on shipping was arrested in January for alcohol consumption. And there has been a recent series of mass trials of men accused of homosexuality. According to Amnesty International, a Houthi court in Damar, northern Yemen, sentenced 9 men to death, with 7 sentenced to be executed by stoning and 2 by crucifixion. 23 others were given prison sentences of between 6 months and 10 years on charges including homosexuality and immoral acts. On 1st of February, a court in IBB in southern Yemen handed death sentences to 13 students and flogging to 3 others on charges of spreading homosexuality. According to the European Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, Houthi courts have sentenced 350 people to death since taking over the capital, Sana'a, in 2014 and executed 11 of them. Page 6. Fair Free London wins union support, environment by Daniel Randall. Fair Free London, FFL, the new campaign demanding free public transport in the capital, took a modest but important step forward recently when it was backed by the London Transport Regional Council of the RMT Union, following a motion I moved through my own branch, RMT Bakerloo Line. The London Transport Region represents around 13,000 workers across Transport for London, including London Underground and the Docklands Light Railway. In promoting the campaign in union meetings and discussing the idea of free public transport with workmates, I sometimes encounter the argument that our unions can't support the demand because fares pay our wages. It's understandable fellow workers may think this way, given TfL has since 2018 been forced into a funding model that makes it heavily reliant on fare revenue. When fare revenue vanished during the lockdown, thrusting TfL into financial crisis, the government made a series of bailout payments, but all with restrictive strings attached, including cutting jobs and reforming the state staff pension scheme and conditionals on returning to being self-financing once the bailout funds expired. RMT has consistently and rightly argued that transport as an essential public service should be publicly subsidised. prior to 2015, when the Tories began incrementally reducing the government grants paid to TfL before abolishing it entirely in 2018, fares didn't pay our wages. Endorsing the demand for free public transport funded by government subsidy is an extension of RMT's opposition to the self-financing model that is in line with the union's constitutional commitment to working towards a socialist society. Union policy already supports social provision of services such as healthcare and education free at the point of use and funds by progressive taxation, so why not transport too? The demand for free public transport is an example of what says what have historically been known as transitional demands. It responds to the immediate material needs of working class people, both in terms of our need to travel freely and affordably and our need to confront the climate crisis. It is winnable, as the introduction of free transport in several cities, including Tallinn and Montpellier, shows. Even New York is trialling free travel on a limited number of bus routes, but it also points the way to a different kind of society by pushing against the rule of profit and the idea that the services we all need to live should be paid for commodities. On recent weeks, FFL activists have also addressed the Unite Community branch in East London and Greenwich Green Party. Simon Pirani spoke on behalf of the campaign at the Campaign Against Climate Change Trade Union Group Conference on 13th of April. The campaign also plans to contact other transport workers, trade unionists, including Unite reps and activists in the bus sector. Winning the demand is undoubtedly a long way off, but the start the campaign has made in promoting it and winning support in key trade union bodies gives us a platform to build from. Daniel Randall is an RMT activist and a member of the Fare Free London organising group, writing here in a personal capacity. Boris Savinkov, a counter-revolutionary, debate by Martin Thomas. Eric Lee in Solidarity 705 writes of Boris Savinkov as a forgotten revolutionary. Fascist would be a better word, I think. In August 1917, Savinkov was a leading figure in the failed attempt by a right-wing general, Lev Kornilov, to overthrow Russia's provisional government. Leon Trotsky, writing with hindsight, calls Kornilov's a fascist revolt. Kornilov wanted to suppress the Soviets, the elected workers and soldiers' councils, and re-stabilize the army for war, but not a straight return to rule by the Tsar. The provisional government he aimed to oust was not elected, but it included many nominal socialist and bourgeois ministers too, and owed its authority to support from the Petersburg Soviet, led at that time by Mensheviks and SRs. The government's leader, the nominal socialist revolutionary SR Alexander Kerensky, had hoped to use Kornilov to suppress the Soviets and quell the Bolsheviks. Kornilov became impatient, moved against Kerensky too. The Bolsheviks fought for a united front to stop Kornilov and succeeded. That success was the basis for them winning the majority in the Petersburg Soviet and then in the Second Congress of Soviets. As far as I know, the SRs expelled Savinkov, long only a nominal member, after the Kornilov episode. After the elected Congress of Soviets voted the Bolsheviks to power in October 1917, it was the most democratic revolution in history. Kornilov, who had been jailed after his revolts but now escaped, teamed up with the other white generals and had loyal troops in the south of the Russian Empire. According to his own accounts, Savinkov quickly joined them. He wrote of their program, quotes, "Dissociation from democracy constituted a political mistake. It gave reason to accuse the Don Civil Council of disguising reactionary behavior, Even the Council of the Union of Cossack Troops, which represents moderate Cossack democracy, was dissatisfied with the policies of General Alexeev, Kaladiv, and Kornilov. I tried to convince them that it was necessary to include democratic elements to front the enterprise. After long negotiations, General Alexeev, Kaladin, and Kornilov agreed with me." End quotes. While Savinkov was hastening to Kornilov and Kaladin, were the Bolsheviks suppressing criticism wholesale? No. They were negotiating with the Mensheviks and the SRs for a coalition government based on the elected Soviets. The revolutionary government had no state machine. The old police had disappeared months before. The old army was falling apart. The Soviet government officially dissolved it in early 1918, and the old civil service refused to cooperate. The Bolsheviks, with no authority other than their democratic mandate from the Soviets and scrappy Red Guards militias, were scrabbling to create a functioning administration. Several Bolsheviks resigned in November from their posts on the Central Committee or as People's Commissars because they thought the Bolsheviks were not being soft enough in the coalition talks. Eventually, even those right Bolsheviks became convinced that the Mensheviks and right SRs could not be conciliated and rallied. A coalition was negotiated, though only with the left SRs, and began to govern. The Mensheviks, as a congress in December, voted to recognize October as a genuine, though in their view, mistaken workers' revolution, and for the critical support to the Bolshevik left SR government against their Kornilovs. During the Civil War, some Mensheviks sided with the Whites, and the Menshevik leadership never split with them. In June 1918, Savinkov moved to Samara, where he helped set up an SR-dominated political facade for counter-revolution, first under the protection of the Czechoslovakian Legion, then of another right-wing general, Alexander Kolchak, until Kolchak tired of the decoration and dispersed the SR politicians. Going into exile, Savinkov sought support from Winston Churchill and Mussolini. They were overruled or reluctant, but Savinkov concluded after meeting Mussolini, quotes, "Fascism is close to me psychologically and ideologically because it stands for action and total effort in comparison to the lack of will and the storied, starry-eyed idealism of parliamentary democracy." End quotes. Savinkov had once been an anti-Tsarist revolutionary, a leader of the SR's special unit for individual assassinations of Tsarist officials. That tells us more about the political dangers for revolutionaries of having such unaccountable military units that it does about any supposed democratic virtues of Savinkov. Page 7. Kass Final Report, A Major Setback, by Ricky Lane. The final report from Hilary Kass on UK gender identity services for children and adolescents has some good recommendations, but overall has ended up feeding hostility towards trans people. It implicitly frames trans people as not real, but having a mental health disorder. The associated NHS decision to rule out puberty blockers for young trans people, except when they are on a yet-to-be-established clinical trial is a huge setback. Looking at the positives first, the review highlights the woeful level of service provision. NHS waiting lists are over 5 years, meaning that many young people age out before seeing a clinician. It recommends expanded capacity through a distributed service model, a holistic assessment, and individual care plans. However, similar recommendations from the 2022 interim report have not been enacted by the NHS. Downside. On the downside, there are multiple problems with the review's methodology and what evidence and what people have been included and excluded. The review rejected the vast majority of evidence relating to puberty blockers, medication to delay puberty given to children facing early puberty and to some young trans kids, and included only two of 102 studies. The argument is that the excluded studies do not include a no treatment group, and none of them have a blinded group, a group which doesn't know whether it is getting placebo or the medication. But there are strong ethical arguments for why you cannot deny appropriate treatment, and you cannot run a blinded group for puberty blockers. Those who are not receiving them will know because they will undergo puberty. The claim of a low level of evidence is based on excluding the large body of evidence that guides professional organisations around the world, which have produced guidelines and standards of care. As Peng et al. 2022 put it when discussing the 2022 CAS review interim report, quotes, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Endocrine Society, and the World Professional Association for Transgender Health have all endorsed the use of these hormonal treatments in gender-diverse young people, but curiously, this consensus-based clinical guidelines and positive statements receive little or no mention, end quotes. The Australian Professional Association for Trans Health has established local guidelines, and the board commented, quotes, the CAS review dismisses decades of research and support for the efficacy of puberty blockers and gender-affirming hormones in gender-affirming care and effectively recommends that gender-affirming care be replaced primarily with psychotherapy and antidepressants, with gender-affirming hormones and puberty blockers to be considered only with extreme caution and by a national multidisciplinary team, end quotes. The CAS reviews, assurance committee and other structures includes no trans people and did not include clinicians implementing the consensus standards of care. However, they did include people who challenged the use of puberty blockers and treat trans people as mentally ill. There is a large contrast between what is happening in the UK and in Australia. In recent years in Australia, state-funded public health, public hospital gender clinics for children and adolescents have been established across the country. They face staffing pressures, but the government's response has been much more supportive than in the UK. The longest established of these clinics at the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne set up an ongoing cohort study in 2020 to allow assessments of long-term outcomes for their clients. And in 2023, the federal government awarded a large research grant, $5 million over 4 years, to compare the models of care and their outcomes across all gender clinics in their country. I personally am excited to be an investigator on that research project. Overall, the CAS reviews represent a major blow to providing affirming care to young trans and gender diverse people. As Freddie McConnell put it, quotes, If the CAS review was held under a black light, we would see the fingerprints of an anti-trans ideology. I don't believe CAS shares this way of thinking. I think she believes in evidence-based healthcare and the trans children, and that trans children exist. However, allowing her review to be so heavily influenced by bias is a critical failure that is hers to own. As her work is used, it will be, to perpetuate a broader hostile environment towards trans people in the UK, the young people she has tried to help will understandably feel betrayed. End quotes. I work in research positions at an Australian university and a gender clinic, and a member of the Australian Professional Association for Trans Health Research and Education Committees. My view on this article are in a private capacity and not on behalf of those organisations. Labour Shift to the Right by Chris Reynolds. The election results for Young Labour and Labour Students' Committees announced 8th of April were bad for the left. In the 2022 elections, slates backed by the Labour left group Momentum won majorities on both committees, though the Labour students' majority then let rings be run round by the chair and secretary, both soft left, open Labour. This time Labour right candidates won almost a clean sweep. For Labour students, Chair Ruby Herbert won 255 to 141 for Anya Wilkinson, left, and 73 for Anna Baxter, Open Labour. Jack Lubner got 2,397 votes for Young Labour Chair against 1,135 for the Left's Alex Cherrillo. Since 2022, the left vote has shrunk rather than the right vote expanding. The tiny turnouts indicate poorer organising effort on the left. Momentum has 11 paid staff, more any pre-Corbyn Labour left groups ever had. And there is now a small network of left student Labour clubs with a bit of energy, more votes could have been turned out. Ruby Herbert's first political statement after being elected was to criticise the Labour leadership on trans rights. Anecdotally, the shaping thought of such people seemed to be not full-on Blairism, but a foolish idea of being loyalist up to the general election, then using credit gained to seek a word in the Labour leader's ear. The results should worry us for the national executive and other elections coming up this year. Nominations from local Labour parties have to be in by the 28th of June. May meetings are also likely to decide local Labour delegates to Labour conference. Starmer gives total pledge to army industry by Colin Foster. Keir Starmer told Daily Mail readers, 12th of April, quotes, "I want to be crystal clear to Mail readers. My commitment to NATO and the UK's nuclear deterrent maintained on behalf of NATO allies is unshakable, absolute, total." End quotes. He continued with pledges of increased military spending and definite updates to the nuclear-armed submarine fleet and British sourcing of supplies. If only he were half as clear to working class people about the NHS or childcare. Jeremy Corbyn's election as leader in 2015 brought an odd twist to Labour politics on Trident. Before then, many even on the soft left disliked Trident's replacement. Even the Labour right would claim only that the nuclear weapons were a sad necessity until multilateral nuclear disarmament could be negotiated. Many better heavy construction projects could offer better jobs. But probably because of pressure from the big unions, Unite and GMB, Jeremy Corbyn, John McDonnell and the new leadership decided that Trident had to be put in the too hard box. The issue disappeared from Labour conferences. We need to get it back there, especially in times when the Labour leaders talk about right budgets. Trident replacements will cost £31 billion. Pages 8 to 10. Study, explain, agitate. How Socialists Organise by Sean McGammer. The Road to Bolshevism. Ninth in a series of articles around the 100th anniversary of the death of Vladimir Ulyanov Lenin by Sean McGammer. Earlier articles have recounted the prehistory of the Russian Marxist movement in revolutionary populism. Before we go on further about the first Russian Marxist groups, we will first ask with Georgi Plekhanov, what is the socialist movement and what do socialists do? Plekhanov, the pioneer of the Russian Marxist movement, answered this fundamental question in his 1891 text, The Tasks of the Russian Social Democrats in the Famine. This is one of the basic documents of Russian socialism, and we print part of it here. The turn made by the Marxist circles in Russia, mostly small study groups of students and especially studious workers, to mass agitation among the workers in the mid-1890s was directly inspired by the 1894 pamphlet on agitation by Kremer and Martov. The whole question had already been brilliantly outlined by Plekhanov here, and also in work by Pavel Axelrod. Plekhanov's exposition of what Marxist socialists are and do, and of the relationship of socialist agitation against details of the life imposed on workers by capitalism to our socialist overview and its propagation, is also as relevant to our work in the 21st century as to that of the pioneer Russian socialists. My comments on the excerpts from Plekhanov that follow are indented. Tasks of the Socialists. If you had such a question, what is the socialist movement? What do socialists do? To a socialist in the 1830s, to one of the followers of the famous Fourier, for instance, he would have replied more or less in the following manner. Our brilliant teacher discovered and expounded in his works a whole series of truths whose existence mankind had not previously suspected. On the basis of these discoveries, he worked out a detailed plan of the new social order, which alone can save man from his countless moral and material misfortunes. The contemporary socialist movement, the true socialist movement and worthy of the name, is resolved to spread the ideas of our teacher and to realize them in practice. An answer of this sort would have been quite correct in the 1830s. At that time, the socialist movement was really concerned to spread the idea of the various schools of socialism and to try to realize them in practice. In these circumstances, each school clearly thought that the teaching of its particular founder was the true socialism. Sean McGammer. Some of them, the followers of Englishman Robert Owen and Frenchman Etienne Cabet, for example, formed utopian socialist colonies in some wilderness or other. Cabet in Texas, where the colony survived for some decades and after its foundation in the 1840s, intending those to be the beginnings of the new society. Plekhanov. But now things are different. To a contemporary socialist, the socialist movement does not look anything like it did to the socialist in the 1830s. Even shortly before the revolutionary year of 1848, there emerged among the socialists men who looked at socialism in a completely new perspective. Seen in this new perspective, the principal error of previous socialists was precisely the fact that, for them, future history resolves itself in their eyes into propaganda and the practical implementation of their social plans. The socialists with a new outlook saw in the future history of the civilized world something else, something incomparably more promising. What precisely did the socialists with a new outlook see in it? Above all, the class struggle, the struggle of the exploited with the exploiters, the proletariat with the bourgeoisie. In addition, they saw in it the inevitability of the impending triumph of the proletariat, the fall of the present bourgeois social order, the socialists' organization of production, and the corresponding alteration in the relationships between people, i.e. even the destruction of classes, among other things. Although they knew full well, better than their predecessors, that the socialist revolution involves a complete transformation in all social relationships, the socialists of the new tendency did not concern themselves at all with working out a plan for the future organization of society. They thought this is a complete waste of time because the details of the future order would be determined in their own time by circumstances that it was impossible to foresee, and its general principles would be sufficiently determined by a scientific critique of existing social relationships, i.e. by a critique based not on the sympathies and antipathies of the reformers, but on an examination of the historical development of the present social order. The socialists with a new outlook broke once and for all with utopias and took their stand on the basis of science. If for the followers of Marxist scientific socialism the whole future history of bourgeois society resolves itself in the struggle of the proletariat with the bourgeoisie, all their practical tasks are prompted by precisely this class struggle. Standing resolutely on the side of the proletariat, the new socialists do everything in their power to facilitate and hasten its victory. But what exactly can they do in this case? A necessary condition for the victory of the proletariat is its recognition of its own position, its relations with its exploiters, its historic role, and its socio-political tasks. For this reason, the new socialists consider it their principal, perhaps even their only duty, to promote the growth of this consciousness among the proletariat, which for short they call its class consciousness. The whole success of the socialist movement is measured for them in terms of the growth in the class consciousness of the proletariat. Everything that helps this growth they see as useful to their cause, everything that slows it down as harmful. Anything that has no effect one way or the other is of no consequence for them. It is politically uninteresting. There is no doubt that the development of capitalism hastens the social revolution. Consequently, every bourgeois whose activity furthers the development of capitalism hastens the social revolution. But it would be very strange if, because of this, someone were to think of the bourgeois activists as socialists. Even people whose activity is directly aimed at fighting socialism can hasten the social revolution. Some German social democrats think that the famous law of exclusion against the socialists issued by the Iron Chancellor Otto von Bismarck in 1878 has to some extent helped their party. If this view is correct, then it follows that Bismarck, in introducing the law of exclusion, has by the very fact hastened the social revolution in Germany. But who would describe as a socialist the man who was trying to deal the death blow to the Social Democratic Party? I reiterate that however much you have discussed the consequences of your political activity, you will only be recognized as a socialist if your activity has directly facilitated the growth of the class consciousness of the proletariat. If it does not exert the direct influence, then you are not a socialist at all, even though the more or less remote consequences of your non-socialist activity may bring some degree of advantage for the cause of socialism. In identifying the most important and most direct sign of socialist activity, I do not wish to say that anyone who does not want to betray the red flag should unfailingly engage either in writing socialist books or in distributing them, and generally in propaganda among the proletariat and its organizations. Individuals belonging to the Socialist Party may be involved in other matters without ceasing to be socialists for a single moment. Let us suppose, page 9, the Socialist Party of a particular country has decided to arrange secret hiding places for its members who are facing government persecution. It entrusts the matter to me and to several other comrades. We willingly and zealously carry out this assignment. Our individual activity is not directly aimed at the development of the class consciousness of the proletariat, but it is conceivable that in doing this we cease to be socialists. No one could say that. But why should they not say that? Because in engaging in this activity, not only did we remain members of the party that directly promotes the growth of the class consciousness of the proletariat, but we also undertook this activity on its instructions. Another example, the Socialist Party of a particular country decides that in the near future it will have to come out into open conflict with the government. The success of its struggle depends to a great extent, of course, on how the army behaves at such a decisive moment. And so the party assigns a certain number of its members to engage in revolutionary propaganda in the army. The soldiers may, of course, be regarded as proletarians in military uniform. Consequently, as far as the people who explain the ideas of socialism to them are concerned, the question that interests us cannot even arise. But that question is entirely appropriate for the people who deal exclusively with the officers. Do these people cease to be socialists? Not at all. Why not then? Once again, because their activity is determined by the needs of the party that directly promotes the growth of the class consciousness of the proletariat. And if they had not belonged to it, in that case they would have ceased to be socialists, because then their work would immediately have lost any connection with the direct and immediate socialist cause. One could cite very many such examples, but my view, I hope, is sufficiently clear. It is expressed in its entirety in the epigraph in this letter. Without workers who are conscious of their class interests, there can be no socialism. The conflict between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie is not the contrivance of the socialists of a particular school, and is by no means a tactical device dreamed up by a fanatical revolutionary, but is that same fateful historical inevitability as work, as was the conflict between the bourgeoisie and the feudal aristocracy in its own time. Sean Magama. But having said that, Plekhanov qualifies it. What follows about the nature and connection of agitation and propaganda will guide the consistently revolutionary Russian Marxists during the expansion of the labor movement in the 1890s and after. In What Is to Be Done, Lenin will base much of his argument against the so-called economists in his work of Plekhanov. See the chapter entitled "How Martynov Rendered Plekhanov More Profound." Back to Plekhanov. If I assert that the promotion of the growth of the class consciousness of the proletariat is the sole purpose and the direct and sacred duty of the socialists, then this does not mean that the contemporary socialists stand for propaganda alone, and for nothing but propaganda. In the broad sense of the word, this is perhaps true, but only in a very broad sense. When at the International Congress in Paris in 1889, the socialists resolved to strive for the 8-hour day, they obviously had it in mind that workers' demonstrations in favour of their resolution would be a marvellous method of propagating their case. But a demonstration is at the same time a method of agitation. In general, it is not easy to draw the line between agitation and what is usually called propaganda. Agitation is also propaganda, but propaganda that takes place in particular circumstances, that is, in circumstances in which even those who would not normally pay any attention are forced to listen to the propagandist's words. Propaganda is agitation that is conducted in the normal everyday course of the life of a particular country. Agitation is propaganda occasioned by events that are not entirely ordinary and that provoke a certain upsurge in the public mood. Socialists would be very bad politicians if they were not to use such notable events even for their own ends. Let us suppose that the agitation in favour of the 8-hour day has been crowned with success. Frightened by constantly growing pressure from the workers' movement, the bourgeoisie has yielded. In all civilised countries, the law has limited the working day to 8 hours. This is a great victory for socialism, but the question arises. There were, of course, socialists among them. There were many socialists who played a leading role, stepping out in front and sweeping the hesitant and the indecisive along in their wake. But were there really then people who were hesitant and indecisive? Why did they hesitate? Why were they indecisive? Probably because they had not fully appreciated the benefits of the 8-hour day, and because on a general level, not having assimilated socialist ideas, they were not yet imbued with the thirst for the battle for a better future that is aroused by a consistent and ordered revolutionary outlook. In a word, these people were not yet socialists, but now look at what has happened. The socialists have drawn people who were not yet socialists into the struggle for a cause that will be very useful to socialism. In other words, people who are not yet socialists have already been working for socialism, and it is agitation that has done this. Because of this, socialists can use for the cause not just the forces that belong to them at the present time, but also those that will belong to them only subsequently. What has happened is rather like drawing on the socialist accounts which history will pay for. And this payment will bring the victory of socialism significantly closer. Propaganda, in the strict sense of the word, would lose all historical significance if it were not accompanied by agitation. Propaganda conveys the correct views to dozens, hundreds, thousands of people, but people holding the correct views only become historical activists when they exert a direct influence on public life. And influence on the public life of contemporary civilized countries is unthinkable without influence on the mass, i.e. without agitation. In barbaric despotism, such as Tsarist Russia, things are different. The mass has no importance, but we are not talking about them. Consequently, agitation is essential for any party that wishes to have a historical meaning. A sect may be content with propaganda in the narrow sense of the word, but a political party never. If I had to clarify further the relationship between agitation and propaganda, I should add that the propagandist conveys many ideas to a single person or to a few people, whereas the agitator conveys only one of a few or a few ideas, but he conveys them to a whole mass of people, sometimes almost the entire population of a particular locality. But history is made by the mass. Consequently, agitation is the aim of propaganda. I conduct propaganda so I shall have the opportunity to transfer to agitation. However, let us return to our example. We suppose that the socialists had managed to secure an 8-hour day by law. Such a law brings very great benefits to the working class. Even the least advanced, least comprehending and most backward workers soon become convinced of this once it has become a reality. And they all know that the 8-hour day was introduced on the initiative of socialists. For this reason, all workers, even the most backward, will be thoroughly convinced that the realization of at least some socialist demands benefits the working class, and this knowledge will in any case bring them incomparably closer to the complete sympathy with, going on page 10, socialism, from then a complete indifference to socialist teaching would have done. Let us go further. By increasing the worker's leisure time, the 8-hour day gives him the opportunity for greater intellectual development and consequently for the easier assimilation of socialist ideas. That means that in this way to the 8-hour day brings nearer the inevitable reckoning. It hastens the revolution, the social revolution. We have seen that social relations in Russia are changing very rapidly. The mutual relationship between the social forces does clearly change with them. The autocracy weakens as the historical soil has nurtured it, crumbles and decomposes. At the same time, some forces are growing stronger and stronger, and it is the collision with these forces that drives autocracy to its ruin. This means that while our propaganda is training revolutionaries, history creates the revolutionary milieu essential for their activity. While we are preparing the leaders of the revolutionary mass, the officers and the NCOs of the revolutionary army, this very army is being created by the inevitable course of social development. But if that is so, we must not describe our activity as fruitless or unproductive. On the contrary, is it not absolutely necessary and uniquely productive from the revolutionary point of view? Drama. On the one hand, it is clear that as long as the individuals that we have propagandized exert no direct revolutionary influence on the mass, they are only its leaders in theory. If they are to become its leaders in reality, they will have to influence them in the revolutionary sense. That is where agitation comes into its own. Thanks to it, the necessary link between the heroes and the crowd, between the mass and its leaders, is established and strengthened. The more strained matters become, the more this old social edifice will rock, and the more rapidly the revolution approaches, the more important agitation will become. To it belongs the principal role in the drama that we call the social revolution. From it follows that if the Russian socialists want to play an active role in the coming Russian revolution, they must know how to become agitators. This is essential, but it is not easy. The task of the agitator involves putting into circulation, in each particular case, the maximum possible number of revolutionary ideas in a form that is accessible to the mass. For every mistake he makes one way or another, a harsh punishment awaits the agitator. If he overestimates the revolutionary mood of the mass, he will at best remain unintelligible, but he may be ridiculed or even assaulted. If, on the other hand, because of extreme caution he puts to the mass demands that it has already outgrown on its rapid revolutionary development, he will fall into the awkward position of agitator break, an agitator who inspires the crowd with moderation and tender conscience. The whole skill of the agitator consists on his ability to avoid such excesses. But if he has the skill, he has no need to fear failure. His task will be carried out of its own accord. We may perhaps say that he is giving the mass nothing, he is only giving full conscious expression of to the attitudes that it already holds, which it is not itself aware of. But in this lies the secret of his influence and the guarantee of his future successes. Seeing in his words merely the expression of its own demands, the mass willingly follows him, and it may even itself push ahead of the agitator. Realizing that only yesterday it was still frightened by its boldness and novelty, it rapidly goes further, inclining to more daring demands. In this way, learning from its own experience, carried along it by its own movement, encouraged by its own success, it gradually, but on the other hand assuredly, becomes more and more revolutionary, until the end it deals with a single decisive movement, the death blow to its existing order. But when the edifice of this order, made shaky, weak and decrepit by history, is shattered, new tasks will unfold before it. It will have to build things better in its new home, not falling into the net of political exploiters, flatterers and tricksters. Then the service and the directions of its devoted agitator friends will be just as important for it as they were earlier in the heart of the struggle with the old order. Orators are born according to the well-known saying, agitators are also born, and no science can replace the inborn agitational gift. Agitation cannot be conducted according to a particular pattern, but if this does not prevent us from thinking about its significance and preparing for it with all the means at our disposal at a time when we can foresee that there will soon be a broad scope for agitational activity. A necessary condition for this activity is a merge of the revolutionary forces that have already been prepared. Through circle propaganda, we can involve people who have no connection with one another and do not even suspect one another's existence. Of course, the absence of organization always affects propaganda, but it does not make it impossible. Organization. In epochs of greater social upheaval, when the political atmosphere is charged with electricity, and when here and there, for the most varied, most unforeseen reasons, there are increasingly frequent explosions that testify to the approach of the revolutionary storm. In short, when it is necessary either to agitate or rally to the flag. In these epochs, only organized revolutionary forces can exert a serious influence on the course of events. The individual is then powerless, and only units of a higher order are equal of the revolutionary task, revolutionary organizations. Organization is the first, the essential step. However insignificant the prepared revolutionary forces of contemporary Russia, they will be increased tenfold by organization. Counting their forces and stationing them where appropriate, the revolutionaries set to work. By means of spoken and pointed propaganda, they spread the correct views of the causes of the present famine through all strata of the population. Wherever the mass is not yet sufficiently advanced to understand their teaching, they give it, as it were, object lessons. They appeal wherever it protests. They protest with it. They explain for it the meaning of its own movement, and hence they increase its revolutionary preparedness. In this way, the elemental movements of the mass gradually merge with the conscious revolutionary movement, and the idea that Zemsky Sober, the constitutional constituent assembly, must be summoned because increasingly popular. Summoned becomes increasingly popular. The Russian people becomes more and more convinced that it must snatch its fate from the hands of Tsarist officials. This is one side of things. On the other side, we must ensure that the people, once it has risen against the existing order, should win the political rights for itself and not political privileges for its exploiters. Direct universal suffrage and is the first and most important demand of the Russian socialists. Their other demands are very closely related: freedom of the spoken word, of assembly, of association, freedom to strike, etc., etc. The agitators must win the mass over to every one of these demands. But from which stratum will the people's representatives in the assembly be elected? Direct universal suffrage certainly does not guarantee that the workers will not elect their bosses, the poor peasants, their kulaks or landowners, and generally that the exploited will not elect the exploiters. Direct universal suffrage is a double-edged sword which the government or the bourgeoisie can easily direct against us. How should we fend off their blows? The workers will only stop voting for his boss when he recognises the irreconcilable contradiction that exists between his own economic interests on the one hand and the interests of the boss on the other. As soon as he does recognise this, he will know longer wants to be the political tool of the exploiter, and he will try to give political expression to his economic needs. He will give his votes to the socialist. The poor peasant will only stop voting for the kulak, rich peasant, the landowner, or the government candidate when the Socialist Workers' Party, in putting forward its well-known economic demands like those outlined above, for instance, demonstrates to him that there is a close connection between his interests and the interests of the revolutionary proletariat. Consequently, we come once more to the familiar conclusion that our political agitation will bear fruit for us only if it corresponds to the growth in the class consciousness of the proletariat. The class consciousness of the proletariat is the protective layer that deflects, like water off on a duck's back, all the attacks of the parties opposed to us. I am coming to the end. I have openly set forth our views on the task of the Russian socialists in the struggle with the causes of the famine in Russia, and I hope that now there can be no misunderstanding on that account. I welcome those who agreed with them as comrades, and I remind those who find them too extreme that we are socialists, and that in the eyes of socialists, moderation is by no means something to be proud of. People will probably tell me that the time is not ripe for an open exposition of our views because this could frighten the liberals. To halt to that, I reply, it would be absurd on our part to frighten them deliberately. But if by chance they are frightened by us, of us, against our will, then we can only pity them completely, their completely inopportune timidity. In any case, for us, the most insidious form of intimidation is the intimidation of socialists by the spectre of the intimidated liberal. The harm done by this intimidation is infinitely greater than the advantage to be gained by convincing the liberal gentlemen of our moderation and our tender consciousness. Pages 11 and 12. The Chartist Non-Revolution of 1848 by Sam Harrison. In 1848, a year of revolution, from French radicals and Irish nationalists to the various Democrats and liberals throughout the rest of Europe, thousands across the continent took to open demonstrations and uprisings with demands ranging from national sovereignty to expanded democracy and improved workers' rights. If it was a truly revolutionary movement spurred on by the unbearable oppression of the masses, but a year of revolution, it was not only. Indeed, it is perhaps better to remember 1848, as Marx wrote in his letter analysis, in his later analysis of class struggles in France, as a year of the total defeat of revolution. And a defeat it was. If one was lucky enough to have not been killed or imprisoned during one of those often ramshackle revolutions, really was their lasting democratic change. With the Chartist movement in Britain, the major active radical movement in Europe over the previous decade, the revolution was defeated before it could even begin. Beginning with the publishing of the People's Charter in 1838, the Chartist movement sought six primary reforms, perhaps chief among them being universal male suffrage, which would expand working class parliamentary involvement and reduce political corruption. By 1848, the Chartists were a massive movement. Millions of workers supported Chartism and were active as part of the movement in one way or another. Few workers' movements in Britain since have come close to rivaling their size, strength, and revolutionary potential. Very quickly, in 1848, the Chartists became aware of the revolutionary wave hitting their comrades abroad. And very quickly did they, too, become participants within it. Unlike their comrades abroad, however, who took up arms, threatened revolt, and in some instances attempted to outright overthrow the bourgeois leaders who challenged or temporarily replaced the old aristocratic regimes, the Chartists chose a form of action more familiar to them. The Chartists created a petition. This was a beloved form of political participation for the disenfranchised working class, working masses. The Chartists sent three mass petitions to Parliament demanding the implementation of the People's Charter in 1839, in 1842, and finally in 1848. Each petition was rejected by a Parliament for which fewer than 500,000 in the 1847 election voted, out of a population of nearly 30 million. Until 1848, each rejection was accompanied by the growth of a revolutionary spirit within the British workers. Whether it be by bullets, pike, or the expansion of British trade unionism, the working class sought its own emancipation in a variety of dangerous, bloody ways. The 1839 Chartist petition, for instance, contained over 1 million signatures, saw its rejection followed by disorganised attempts at radical violence in the Newport uprising and attempted further uprisings in Sheffield and Bradford, all involving and leading to death, injury, and imprisonment. In 1842, the 1842 petition, with over 3 million signatures now, also saw further radical backlash following its rejection in the general strike and large-scale riots of that year. The strikers were forced back to work. Regardless of their defeats, however, the Chartists were setting up a significant trend that workers, in the wake of the failure of peaceful parliamentary means, would organise themselves in increasingly sophisticated, radical, and sometimes revolutionary ways. In 1848, where after a gathering of 50,000 Chartists in London for the presentation of their mass petition of over 5 million signatures in the April of that year, Parliament could still not be swayed. A Commons committee made the impossible claim to have counted every single signature within just a few days. It said it found fewer than 2 million legitimate ones, and soon thereafter the entire petition was rejected. So how did the workers of Britain respond? Did those 50,000 Chartists in London and millions nationally who signed the rejected petition join their foreign comrades capturing a continent-wide revolutionary wave. They did not. There was no mass radical or revolutionary event following the failure of the 1848 petition. The largest workers' movement ever at that time, one so large and sophisticated that it is rivaled by few movements in the nearly 20th century, 22 centuries since, went into a decade of decline. The Chartists' movements faded away, and cautious craft unions came to dominate the workers' movement. There was never another Chartist petition, and there was no working class revolution in Britain. That is where some popular histories of the Chartists and the revolutions of 1848 may end. Britain and the Chartists were an outlier in 1848, never having, moving on to page 12, joined in the revolution as their radical European counterparts had. The Chartist movement could be considered by some to have been a failure, having achieved none of its demands on its own. That take, however, faded out not only the revolutionary potential the Chartist movement had by 1848, but also of their impact on the entire history of the working class struggle since. Some Chartists demanded that the petition be forced through Parliament at threat of violence, and there were Chartist riots, such as those in Trafalgar Square in March 1848. There was an undeniably radical and militant feeling within at least some of the Chartist movements in that year. Some, following their refused petition, indeed did plan for revolution in 1848. A secret revolutionary committee was set up in the National Charter Association, planning for a June revolt of workers in London. When that committee was shut down due to fears over police spies, however, planning moved outside of the National Charter Association. 16th of August became the date for a Chartist revolution in London, one in which it was claimed that 5,000 Englishmen and just as many Irishmen were ready to take the city and Parliament. It didn't happen. The fear over police spies in June was not simply paranoia, for spies had infiltrated the revolutionary planning process. Not long before the 16th of August, police arrested the leading conspirators and seized all the stockpiled weapons they had gathered. No single signal went out to workers to arm themselves and to take London. Across Europe, radicals were often able to organise and lead uprisings which built on broader and more diffuse democratic outbursts. The Chartists were not. The efforts of a sophisticated police force against those ill-prepared radical Chartists led to the rapid defeat of revolution in Britain in 1848, a defeat which came before the revolution even began. The entire history of the Chartists within their own time, of a movement which died out, having achieved none of its aims, is undeniably one of defeat. But what are the histories of a majority of workers' movements throughout time, if not histories of defeat? The Chartists do not deserve to be relegated to their own time, but instead must be thought of as an early yet vital step in the much wider history of workers' struggle. The Chartists provided, for the first time, a mass workers' movement based on shared class identity and the need for that class to organise itself for its own liberation. It was this radical organisation which instilled, at several points, a militant fever within the workers of Britain. Those who took up arms in Newport in 1839, those who organised strikes in 1842, and those who rioted and planned for revolt in 1848, all played their part in developing a radical class identity in Britain. And it was this class identity which would become vital in the future of radical organising in Britain. Without it, it is unlikely that the trade union movement would have grown as it did on a lasting basis. The big unions before 1834 had all been very short-lived, or that the advances and concessions achieved by and for workers through their strength and organising to the modern day would have been achieved at all. The final truth of the Chartists was well put by Lenin, who described the movement as a last word but one to Marxism. If not for those Chartists and their efforts, radicals and revolutionaries to come would have undeniably had a much more disorganised, weaker and less militant workers' movements to organise with and learn from. Chartism is a vital part of a history of workers' struggles, a history largely of defeat, and it is the defeat that we must take our understanding and our idealism from if we wish to develop and succeed. Back to page 11. Timeline. 1815. Defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo opens an era of reaction across Europe. 1830, July Revolution in France overthrows restored Bourbon monarchy in favour of the Orleanist bourgeois monarchy. 1832, after much agitation, Tory government in Britain concedes reform bill, increasing the electorates from 400,000 to 650,000. 1834, new poor law requiring paupers seeking relief to go into workhouses. 1838, People's Charter launched. From 1839, Anti-Corn Law League, mass bourgeois movements for reform. Chartists keep their independence. 1839, first Chartist petition, Newport Rising. 1842, second Chartist petition, General Strike. February 1848, uprising in Paris. King abdicates, uprising also in the German states. Communist Manifesto published. March 1848, uprisings in Vienna and Berlin. April 1848, Chartists presents third petition. June 1848, workers' uprising in Paris suppressed. October to December 1848, the monarchies regain control in Vienna and Berlin. In France, Louis Bonaparte elected president in France. He will take autocratic power in a coup in 1851 and declare himself emperor in 1852. 1850s, Chartist movement declines, though in 1851 it adopts a much broader social program. New model crafts unions come to dominate. 1864, some revival of workers' movement. London Trades Council plays a role in First International until 1871. Late 1880s, large-scale revival of workers' movement and socialism in Britain. Page 13. Unite Steelworkers Votes to Strike by Katie Toller. Around 1,400 Tartar steel workers, members of Unite, based in Port Talbot and Llanwern, Newport, have voted decisively for industrial action over the company's plan to close its blast furnaces and shed 2,800 jobs. The ballot closed on 9th of April. Community, the majority union in the steelworks, started a ballot on action on 11th of April, and it will run for a month. GMB started the ballot on 5th of April. It will be the first time that Port Talbot steelworkers have struck since the National Steelworkers' Strike of 1980 and the Port Talbot Electricians' Strike of 1977. Unite members returned a majority for strike despite Tata threatening the workers with a loss of enhanced redundancy pay if they did. According to the Times, it was a 66% yes vote on a 63% turnout. Unite General Secretary Sharon Graham said, quote, "This is an historic vote. Not since the 1980s have steel workers voted to strike in this way. This yes vote has happened despite Tata's threats that if workers took strike action, an enhanced redundancy packages would be withdrawn. Unite will be at the forefront of the fight to save steel making in Wales. We will support steel by all and every means. Other EU countries are transitioning their steel industries while retaining and growing their capacity because they know steel has a bright future. A tenfold increase in demand is predicted in the coming years. In the UK, Tata's plans and those of the government reflects the short-term thinking of a clapped-out, disinterested government marking time to a general election. In contrast, Labour have done the right thing and committed £3 billion to the UK Steel following intense discussions with Unite. The average age of a Unite Port Talbot worker is 36. Workers and the communities of Port Talbot and Llanwern are looking to the years ahead. They know that with the right choices, steel making capacity and jobs can be kept and the benefits of growing the industry grasped. In the crucial weeks to come, Tata's workers and Unite will put up picket lines to prevent the company from taking this disastrous path. End quotes. At the Tata plant in the Netherlands, the blast furnaces are being kept open and jobs protected as the company builds an electric arc furnace and invests in hydrogen DRI technology. Unite has announced, quotes, dates for strike action scheduled to cause maximum impact will be announced soon, end quotes. The phrasing suggests the union are not planning for indefinite action, though indefinite strikes are far stronger and more likely to win than sporadic short strikes. Workers at the Tata sites should push for a strategy to win, and that means sustained action. Unions can mitigate worries about sustained strikes by use of strike funds and hardship payments, with fundraising within the labour movement, and by a strategy which workers believe can save the planet. Unison Health Conference ducks pay issue, Unison by a Unison member. The backdrop to the Health Sector Conference, 8th to the 10th of April, of the Public Service Union Unison was an NHS increasingly in crisis. Staff shortages, unsafe staff levels, low pay, privatisation and the impact on people who work in health dominated all of the debates. The conference celebrated and applauded all of those who had struck over this year. But a plan of detailed action over this year's pay was missing. A pay consultation email was sent out to all health members in England the week before conference, but union branches didn't know it was happening, and so it wasn't accompanied by any local campaigns. The approach will not produce results in the consultation. It will allow those in the health service group executive who don't want action to say there is no appetite for it among the members. Health Service Group Executive elections open 22nd of April 2024 and run to 17th of May 2024. A leaflet was circulated from the Unison Left Group Time for Real Change, TFRC, calling on people to vote for candidates who support industrial action on pay. The Socialist Party is also standing candidates in the election. Health workers in Workers' Liberty call for votes for both TFRC and Socialist Party candidates in these elections. Two states. The war in Gaza also dominated the conference. Unison statements for a ceasefire, for an end to arms trading with Israel and for a two-state solution was reiterated. We heard from a speaker from Medical Aid to Palestine and conference stood to demonstrate its support for aid and for a ceasefire. A leaflet was circulated by the Ukraine Solidarity Campaign calling for Unison members to back their motion going to Unison National Delegates Conference in June, supporting the Ukrainian trade unions and Russian withdrawal from Ukraine. A meeting for Unison members with John McDonnell MP will take place in May to encourage Unison members to support the motion and encourage the building of a Ukraine solidarity network of Unison members who are organising solidarity with the Ukrainian unions. West Streeting MP had been invited to speak at the conference. He probably realised he would not be well received, and he didn't come in an election year campaigning to defend and rebuild the NHS and for a pay increase. Needs to be high priority for the largest health union, as to encouraging health workers to vote Labour and using the union's clout in Labour to press our demands. Page 14. Help us raise £15,000 by 21st of July. With Ideas for Freedom now on the weekends of 20 to the 21st of July, we have slightly longer to reach our fundraiser total. We hope we won't need it, but we will have to pick up the pace at our conference to get there. Total so far, 3,692. General secretaries I have known. Diary of a track worker by Matt Shaw. I experienced five general secretaries of my union, NURTH, in RMT, during my career on the railway. Another is coming up shortly, if rumours are to be believed. The first was Sids Whale, 1975 to 83, without doubt the most mendacious of them all. His sole aim in life was to keep the old Communist Party from taking control of his union. No trick was too underhand to use, especially obscure rules from the union rule book. He defied the National Executive on many occasions with the connivance of the Senior Assistant General Secretary, Vernon Hintz, who was lining himself up to take over from Sid when he retired, or more likely died in service. They kept control until 1982, when the first national strike of the NUS, the NUR, took place before dear old Sid managed to get the National Conference to call it off, bypassing the National Executive. At that time, the NUR was nowhere near a democratic member-led union. Sid's downfall came about in 1983 when, at TUC Congress, he cast a vote against the express wishes of the delegation. He first denied it. Over a period of time and some detective work, it proved beyond a shadow of a doubt. He wangled a special recall conference to discuss the affair and expected the conference to refuse to accept an offer from him to resign, effectively to pardon his actions. We, the left in the union, no longer dominated by the CP, managed to mobilise. The vote, while close, but accepted his resignation. Off he went, murmuring about left-wing conspiracies. The next general secretary was Jimmy Knapp, 1983 to 2001. A genial sort of person, he was regarded as a stopgap compromise between Charlie Turnock, preferred by the old bureaucracy, and some one more radical, a sort of NUR version of Arthur Scargill, minus the Stalinoid tendencies. We could not get agreement on who that was, so we compromised on supporting Jimmy Knapp. Knapp was actually in office for 18 years, during which time the railway started changing. Supporting the miners during the 1984 to 85 strike with a boycott of scab coal, the signallers had the support of the union leadership as far as that went. But action was left up to individual signallers, as the union did not want to run foul of the anti-trade union laws. The biggest letdown was not coordinating with the NUM and not calling for a strike over the closure of the pits, which would have directly led to redundancies on the railway and coal no longer being transported by rail. The next layer of bureaucracy inside the union was still the old gang from Sid Wales' time, and Jimmy Knapp never took that on board. His tenure was hamstrung by then, and he was unwilling to get help from the left in the union. Some strikes were called over pay with some success, but the biggest fight against privatization was dodged with the argument that action would be a political strike banned by the anti-trade union laws. A lobbying campaign was launched but had little impact. Knapp died while in office in 2001, his name indelibly linked with that failed fight against privatization of the railway. More on the other three later. The Miners' Hymns, Keno Eye by John Cunningham. Something very different to bring to a conclusion my series of four films for the 40th anniversary of the 1984-85 miners' strike. The Miners' Hymns was premiered in July 2010 in Durham Cathedral, directed by Bill Morrison, the avant-garde filmmaker, with music by Icelandic composer Johan Johansson, the founder of Kitchen Motors, an experimental arts group in Reykjavik. It is a beautiful, poetic celebration of mining culture and particularly its music. Using archive footage, the film features the Big Meeting, otherwise known as the Durham Miners Gala, and the music blends with and highlights the sense of occasion and the solidarity and culture of the mining communities. These emotions are strikingly highlighted by the appearance of the Easington Miners banner as it emerges over the brow of the hill prior to descending to the fields where the gala culminates. The banner is draped in black cloth as a sign of respect and remembrance for the 83 men who died in an explosion in 1951. The band which precedes the banner plays Gresford, also known as the Miners' Hymn. These words by Lee Hall, director of Billy Elliot, taken from the booklets accompanying the British Film Institute's DVD, are very appropriate way to end our filmic commemoration of 1984-85. Quotes. So in remembering, celebrating, lamenting our mining past, we're not paying homage to the dirt, the exploitation, or the circumscribed lives of our forefathers and mothers. We are acknowledging their hope, their aspiration for a better world, but also their lack of tolerance, their anger, their belligerence and their willingness not to accept the blatant lies they were told, their ability to organize and to look after one another, their willingness to deprive themselves individually to fight for the common good. End quotes. Page 15. Wirral CSWs win their battle. Unison by Unison member. 600 NHS clinical support workers, CSWs, on the Wirral have won their long-running dispute for rebanding and back pay. The workers, who are Unison members employed at Arrow Park and Clatterbridge hospitals, have been striking since August 2023. Their demands were to be rebanded from band 2 to band 3 on the agenda for change, NHS pay scale, as they were routinely undertaking clinical tasks such as taking and monitoring blood, performing electrocardiogram tests and inserting cannulas, and for that improved rate to be backdated to 2018. Seven health trusts in the Northwest moved workers to the higher rate and backdated their pay to April 2018. East Cheshire and Mid Cheshire Trusts also agreed to move their staff up to salary band 3 and to provide the same back pay, but the management of the Wirral University Teaching Hospital NHS Trust refused, and the strikes began. It looks as if the It looked that the dispute would be settled in October, but management's plan for back pay then would have left many workers ineligible, so more strikes were necessary. 61 days of strikes won the dispute. Picket lines were lively throughout, strengthened by trade unionists and NHS campaigners visiting them and sending messages of support. Members were involved in meetings with management, and workers' confidence grew even when faced with setbacks. Membership of the union branch doubled as a result. Disputes like this are continuing across the country. They are happening because pay increases have been below inflation for the last 15 years, and because workloads and pressure to take on extra tasks have increased. They demonstrate that strikes can win. They will also, hopefully, give NHS workers the confidence to strike over pay. It is now April, the pay review date, and we should have had a pay rise, but no offer has been made. Unison and other health unions should be demanding an increase that restores NHS pay to where it would have been if our wages had kept pace with inflation, and putting in place a timescale for balloting on pay. We should not let the Tories set the pace. We can pointing to successes like the one in Wirral to show that industrial action in health can be successful. A campaign over pay and safe staffing levels should be built on these victories. Slouching towards the election, off the rails. The Trade Drivers Union, ASLEF, struck on 5th, 6th and 8th of April alongside overtime bans over days surrounding the strikes, in continuation of our dispute over pay since 2022 with train operating companies operating primarily in England. This group of TOCs is represented by an association delivered to as the Rail Delivery Group, but in reality their ability to negotiate with the union on pay is being controlled by the Tory government through the Departments for Transport. Although the union continues to tinker with how it spreads out its industrial action between different TOCs and different days, there is no movement beyond one-day strikes at a frequency of around 6 weeks. The reason is that union leaders have decided that the right way to conduct the dispute is to plod slowly towards a general election, after which Labour will, they believe, deliver on assurances given in private to offer a pay settlement without strings to cover 2022 to 23. The strings are the main reason that this dispute has been at stalemate for the majority of its two-year length. The RDG and DfT are demanding significant worsening of drivers' terms and conditions of employment in return for 4% on pay. Their offer was not designed to be accepted by the union. The union's leaders will need one more successful strike ballot in each of the TOCs to see them through until an election in autumn or winter. They are highly likely to get it. Members know the grave consequences of a no vote in such a ballot, but the reliability of members in delivering strong strike mandates is not translating to confidence on the part of the leadership for the kind of action that could shift the Tory government into improving their offer and put a future Labour government on notice that this is a union willing to fight. Page 16. Galloway's Reactionary Grand Alliance by David Axon. George Galloway's Rochdale Grand Alliance to oppose Labour in the May local government elections is proving neither grand nor even very allied, but it is a threat. In his victory speech at the end of February, he declared a grand alliance against Labour. Not only one of the Rochdale independents he courted has joined his alliance, but only one of his Rochdale independents he courted has joined his alliance. Quotes, Rochdale town councillors have put you on notice that I hope to put together a grand alliance of all the parties. end quotes, he said, and specifically invited the independent David Tully, who came second with 21% of the vote. Quotes, I look forward to working with Mr. Tully, and I hope he will join the Grand Alliance, end quotes. A Workers' Party press release on 7th of April claims the support of David Tully and declared its endorsement as part of the Grand Alliance for 4 Middleton independents and 2 Liberal Democrats. Within hours, both the Middleton independents and the Liberal Democrats had declared they wanted nothing to do with Galloway, and David Tully denied any support. Only Billy Howarth of Parents Against Grooming, who achieved 1.7% of the vote in the February by-election, has been attracted to Galloway's alliance. And even he has said on social media that it was because he was too late to register as an independent party. But Galloway remains a threat in Rochdale. There has been a significant collapse in Labour Party membership and organisation. Labour's right-wing factions and careerist councillors show no interest locally in efforts to build Labour Party membership and activity. Indeed, some activity celebrates the absence of party organisation on the grounds that we told them to account. With a small number of honourable exceptions, Labour Party activity is confined to focus on the local council, with councillors as self-appointed influencers in the community substituting for building active local branches. That can collapse very quickly as a means of maintaining a Labour vote. Labour's canvassing returns in Rochdale so far show that the Labour vote has almost halved in the areas most focused on by Galloway. Many young people in those areas will have voted for Galloway as the first vote of their lives and have no contact with the Labour movement through trade unions or anything else. Labour needs to organise properly in those communities to prevent Galloway's misdirection becoming permanent, and it will be down to the left to do that. But Billy Howarth's new membership of the Workers' Party has attracted some attention outside Rochdale. Howarth has been noted as someone increasingly seen as at far-right events and associated with far-right conspiracy groups and individuals, from Patriots of Britain to John Lawrence and the National Housing Party UK. The Rochdale district of the National Education Union, NEU, has declared itself, quotes, concerned about the transphobic and homophobic finger-crossing as teachers in the Rochdale by-election, end quotes. Galloway's one recruit, Howarth, took the same line in his by-election statement to Rochdale Online, where, oddly, under the immigration heading, he says, quotes, I believe SRE, sex and relationships education, is a problem and will be meeting with schools to see that it can be changed, end quotes. In its campaigning in Rochdale, the Workers' Party says nothing about trade union rights or anything remotely left-wing. The Trade Unionists Against Galloway network has been established independently of any individual union to engage more unions and activists, initially with a social media appeal for support. The purpose of this work is primarily to ensure that if Galloway stands again in Rochdale, there will be a workers' voice against him. Taking the arguments into the unions is important. At the Rochdale NEU meeting that discussed the matter, there were members who had previously known nothing of Galloway's record and who had been unaware of the material he had put out locally in that by-election attacking teachers. Ukraine in a Corner, Arm Ukraine by Dan Katz. On Thursday, the 11th of April, a massive Russian missile and drone attack on Ukrainian energy infrastructure totally destroyed the Tripolska thermal power plant, the largest supply of electricity in the Kyiv region. In this latest attack, Russia fired 82 rockets and drones, including 6 hypersonic Kinzhal missiles. Ukraine's air defences shot down only 57. Ukraine lacks air defence missiles to defend its cities and frontline army units. 200,000 people were left without electricity in Kharkiv, close to the Russian border, which is now facing significant attacks several times each week. On April 1st, Kharkiv Mayor Ihor Terekhov said that Russian attacks had destroyed almost all the city's energy plants. The latest attack ruined a substation. Such attacks on civilian targets are war crimes. Russian President Vladimir Putin claims that the targeting of electricity plants in Ukraine is in retaliation for recent Ukrainian attacks on oil refineries in Russia. However, Russia has aimed to destroy civilian infrastructure since the start of the full-time invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. The intention is to demoralize Ukrainian civilians. Far-right pro-Trump US Republicans continue to hold up a $61 billion US aimed package for Ukraine in the US Congress. Russia is now battering frontline positions using guided high explosives and cluster bombs launched from planes at a range of 40 to 60 kilometers. Russia is dropping these accurate and destructive munitions, which weigh 250 or 500 kilograms at a rate of 500 a week, and Ukraine currently has no answer. Ukraine also has a chronic lack of artillery shells and blames the loss of the destroyed eastern town of Avdiivka in February on the lack of ammunition. On Saturday, 13th of April, Ukraine's new military leader, Oleksandr Syrsky, described the eastern Donbass front as having, quote, deteriorated significantly in recent days, end quote. Ukraine is still destroying Russian armor and military units, but Russia's resources are much greater than Ukraine's, and Russia's political leadership has little interest in preserving the lives of Russian troops. We demand the pro-Ukraine Western powers step up deliveries of munitions and aid to Ukraine. Ukraine's war remains a war of national self-defense against Russian imperialist attack and occupation, not a proxy war fought secretly for US interests, and Ukraine needs arms from the devil if need be. Ukraine's parliament, the Verkhovna Rada, passed a new mobilization bill on the 11th of April. The bill was backed by 283 members of parliament, the majority from President Zelensky's Servants of the People Party. European Solidarity, associated with oligarch Petro Poroshenko, abstained. Some key changes to conscription law had been agreed earlier in the month, in particular reducing the conscription age to 25 and the introduction of an electronic register for conscripts. Ukraine is attempting to press eligible Ukrainian men outside the country to return and sign up, and is threatening to withhold diplomatic services, including passport renewal, to those who refuse. The contentious issue surrounding the debate in Ukraine over the mobilization law is the issue of demobilization. Many Ukrainian troops have been fighting almost continually since February 2022. The draft mobilization law contains a clause allowing for demobilization after 36 months of service. That clause was removed. Ukraine calculates that a new mass Russian offensive is coming, perhaps as early as May, and they need their most experienced fighters in place. As Russia makes gains on the battlefield, opinion, which is difficult to gauge in such a repressive society, seems to be hardening in support of the attack on Ukraine. The Kiev Independence quotes a poll from early February which suggests the Russian minority, which has always opposed the war, is down to 22%, although more than 50% of Russians may want peace talks to end the war. Page 17. No to Iran-Israel War by Ira Berkovic. On Saturday the 13th of April, Iranian forces seized a ship in the Straits of Hormuz, owned by Israeli-linked companies. Then overnight, Iran launched a barrage of drones and missiles towards Israel. The attack was retaliation for a strike on an Iranian diplomatic building in Syria, which killed several military officials. Israeli defences intercepted the attack, which appears to have injured only one person, though the notional aim was surely to kill many civilians. Iranian attacks on Israel are acts of regional imperialist aggression against a rival power conducted by a deeply reactionary political force, motivated by religious fundamentalist and anti-Semitic ideology. Iran's attacks do not help the Palestinians. On the contrary, they could help Netanyahu and his government quell domestic dissent by appealing to a need for national unity in the face of a threat to security. Netanyahu and his far-right allies may go for wider war with Iran. The domestic political benefits of such a war may have been part of Netanyahu's calculation in engaging in actions which risk provoking it. A war between Israel and Iran would also allow Iran's rulers to stoke up nationalism and potentially undermine ongoing protests by women and workers who face stifling oppression as well as dire economic conditions. Iran has said it will not, for now, launch further strikes, but the risk of escalation, either of direct conflict between Israel and Iran or between Israeli and Iranian allies in Lebanon and Yemen, remains high. Conflicts may also escalate in the occupied West Bank. On Friday the 12th and Saturday the 13th of April, Jewish settlers attacked Palestinian homes in the villages of El Maghrivia and Duma. After a 14-year-old child, Benjamin Ahimir, was reported missing, his body later found with an initial investigation suggesting that he'd been killed with a bladed weapon. Dozens of Palestinians were injured and one killed in the settler attacks. Since the Hamas attacks of 7th of October and a siege Israel launched on Gaza in response, almost 500 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed, either by Israeli forces or armed settlers. As Israel has tightened its military control in the area, the likelihood of a much wider conflict breaking out there has increased. In the wake of Ahimir's killing, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant publicly urged settlers not to commit acts of revenge. Such words ring hollow in light of his previous comments describing the population of Gaza as human animals and promising to cut off supplies of food and electricity. Israel's war since 7th of October has been one colossal act of revenge conducted with unrelenting brutality.